Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 3rd of May. It's All Things Political. You always hear All Things Political Monday at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is Mickey Kaus. Mickey is an American journalist, a political blogger. He is the author of the Kaus Files on Slate.com, which is a mostly political blog. He's written about public policy for Newsweek and several other publications, including The New Republic and The Washington Monthly, where he remains a contributing editor. He published The End of Equality in 1992. The book was co-winner of the Washington Monthly Political Book Award. He lives in Los Angeles. And we should also say that he has announced recently that he is going to be, well, he's taken out nomination papers to challenge U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer in June's Democratic primary. He's the son of former State Supreme Justice Otto Kaus, and he portrays himself as a centrist Democrat, has been particularly critical of his party's position on illegal immigration. Immigration, one of the topics, of course, because of demonstrations all over the country over the weekend that we'll be talking about this hour. We'll start, though, with this oil disaster, which is just horrendous. The president toured the region on Sunday. He's been receiving criticism that the administration was too slow to respond and didn't do much to hold off the catastrophe. I don't know what can be done, but of course there will be political ramifications for this. The president's saying that this could seriously damage the economy and the environment of our Gulf states, and it could extend for a long time, jeopardizing the livelihoods of thousands of Americans who call this place home. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Good morning, Mickey. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Let's start with what's going on with this horrendous oil spill, 30 miles long and now closing federal fishing waters for a full 10 days. People don't seem to know how to stop this. Why?
Well, I guess it's very hard. It's gushing out from the bottom of the ocean, so it's very hard to stop. When they describe the volume of oil, it doesn't actually seem to be that bad. But I guess the problem is it never stops coming.
Mm-hmm.
It comes at a very bad time for Obama because it seems to show the weakness in two of his initiatives. One of which was to expand offshore drilling, and nature answered his initiative by saying, this is prone to disasters. And the other thing is the possible expansion of nuclear power, which the administration is known to be considering. If this could happen on an oil spill, imagine if it was a nuclear plant.
Right.
On the other hand, it does seem to give an extra push to the okay of the wind farm off of Massachusetts, because it's hard to imagine a disaster on this scale that could ever happen with that form of energy.
I'm wondering about, I feel so sorry for all of those people who fish there, the animals that we're seeing who are covered with oil. It's just sickening. But these people depend on, obviously, fishing for their livelihood. I guess BP, I don't know if this is true or not, has been trying to pay people $5,000 to keep them from suing. What do you know about that?
I don't know anything about that. That sounds like standard operating procedure. They'd be very ill-advised to take the $5,000. The other possibility, of course, is that there's going to be some big government program to compensate these people.
Right.
And they deserve some compensation, but that can have ill effects, too. You could have basically large chunks of the economy of Gulf Coast states sort of just living on reparations, as it were. And that's unhealthy for them, and in the long term, might not be such a good thing.
Right.
It's sort of a new form of welfare. It's a disaster all around. My impression is that the oil degrades over time, so it isn't like a nuclear accident where it's permanent. It's not going to last thousands of years. The Valdez spill. If you go to Alaska, would you say this area had been destroyed? No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. The president keeps saying BP. He said this many times, actually. This is BP's problem. They're going to pay for this. We'll help in every way we can. But stressing over and over that they're footing the bill. Why so much emphasis on that?
Voters seem to pay perhaps excessive concern over who pays the bill. I find in political campaigns, you know, there'll be some, you know, some initiative on the ballot, and the opponents will say, well, they're spending an extra $2 million on this initiative. Well, let's talk about the substance. Let's not talk about the $2 million. Taxpayers are very, very sensitive to being stuck with the bill. That's one of the reasons why the bailouts are so wildly unpopular. You know, and the Republicans are now trying to cast everything the Democrats do as another bailout. I think Obama's exquisitely sensitive to the who pays issue.
He's been criticized for, I guess, not showing up earlier, for not seeming to have much of a federal plan for response here. Is that justifiable criticism?
It seems to have some merit, although, as you say, what would he have done? It's mainly a PR criticism, and it always happens in the wake of things like this. With Katrina, the difference was that there was some sort of something obvious that Bush could do, send in the National Guard, that he seemed to delay doing for a couple of days. And there were videos of people suffering at the Superdome in Louisiana. This is just a question. He had a plan, but a plan to do what?
Right.
What good would a plan have done? So I think it's not as substantial a criticism, but with Obama, you get the impression that there are some things he's interested in and some things he's not interested in, and this would fall in the not interested category, I think.
He has no choice. He has to be interested in this, don't you think?
He has to be interested for political reasons, but he tends to focus more on the things that, you know, healthcare, the big domestic initiatives and change that he's trying to achieve, the actual day-to-day job of handling whatever crisis comes his way, it just doesn't seem to be job one.
And what does this do? It is interesting that he proposed expanding offshore drilling as a way to meet energy needs, and then this happens. What happens to that idea?
Well, I think the idea is dead, which is very bad for the overall energy legislation, because that was the big concession to industry that was supposed to win support for a lot of other provisions that industry didn't like. And if you knock out that prop, the deal as structured would fall apart. On the other hand, people hate the energy companies even more than they did before, so that might give a political push that would give their lobbyists less power than they had before.
Let's talk, and I know this is a big issue for you. I'm interested to know where you stand on this. Lots of immigration rallies be in protest, mostly of the Arizona law that passed. There was a sign, when was it, last Friday? Time goes so quickly. What's your position on this? I know it's one of the reasons that you're running for Senate.
Yeah, well, I'm running for Senate on because I dissent from the sort of view that all Democrats have to support what's called comprehensive immigration reform, which is a combination of stricter enforcement measures and whatever you want to call it, an amnesty, legalization, some path to citizenship is the way it's usually phrased, for people who are already here illegally. So it's that 1-2 combination. And I think we tried that in 1986. It didn't work. The amnesty part worked, but the enforcement didn't work, and we got another wave of illegal immigrants who are the 12 million where they give amnesty now. And I don't think we can afford to have it happen again and again, to have another 12 million and another 12 million. So I say secure the borders first, make sure it works, wait a few years, and then we can talk about amnesty and the people who are here. Even the most hardline Republicans I talk to, if you talk to them in private, do not, you know, will concede that the people who are here are going to stay here, are going to wind up staying here one way or the other. The issue is the message we send to the world. Has the game changed? Are the borders now really closed to illegals and you have to come here legally? It seems to me that is the issue. The issue of the Arizona law raises is, do we want to strictly enforce the immigration laws that are on the books? I mean, you know, people who are here illegally are here illegally. If we could push a button and somehow miraculously discover them, would we want to take action against them? And I think the answer is no. We'd want them to, we want to let them live in the shadows, as it's called. It would be too disruptive and too cruel to root out people who are here and have in many cases have been here for years. But that doesn't mean you don't want to, you know, have some system that discourages people who are maybe don't have deep roots, and also just reemphasizes the points that they are illegal, which brings us to Arizona, which has been probably worse impacted than other states because they built a fence on most of the California border, which forced the illegal entrance into Arizona. So Arizona is sort of the funnel through which illegals from south of the border come. Now, not all illegals come across the border. A lot of them come by overstaying their visas. That's a different issue. But there have been kidnappings in Arizona. People felt the situation was out of control. They were very worried that the drug violence in Mexico would spill over. And so they passed this measure to give the police another tool to if they've stopped you already, they can ask for some form of documentation, and a driver's license will do. They also said right in the law that they wanted to discourage illegal immigrants from coming to Arizona. That doesn't seem that sensationally awful to me. It's certainly susceptible to abuse. I mean, if you could imagine if the police just sort of routinely swept through immigrant neighborhoods asking everybody for their papers, that would be the first situation of rooting people out who are just minding their own business. I don't think they said that's not going to happen. They passed amendments to the law saying you couldn't even consider race, when you're deciding who to stop and who to ask. It seems to be less of a big deal than the protesters are making it. And my attitude is, on balance, let's see what happens. Let's see if it works. It's a pretty narrowly defined law, and I think we sort of crossed the line in the country where we object to showing our papers. I mean, there are hundreds of situations where we're asked to show our papers, including our driver's license. I probably whip it out about 10 times a day. So I don't think the sort of more hysterical objections to the law have much merit.
Does it pose a pretty big political problem for particularly Republicans? So much has been written lately about this being a very large growing part of the American population and important in voting right now, and the Republicans can't afford to lose the Hispanic vote.
Well, the law is very popular in Arizona, 70%, some polls say. It's not at all. It's not clear whether it's a problem for the Republicans or for the Democrats. It's a problem for both of them. I mean, the Republicans' long-term problem is that they might lose the Hispanic vote, the Latino vote. The Democrats' short-term problem is this law is popular, and if they oppose it, they may feel the anger of first the many non-Latino groups that. Latino voters who vastly outnumber Latino voters, even in California, who support it, and second, there are a lot of Latinos who a minority, but not an insubstantial minority, who support tougher enforcement. So, I tend to think in this election, it's much more of a problem for the Democrats than the Republicans, and in the long term, yes, the Republicans have to somehow come to terms with Latino Americans, but that's a problem they can afford to postpone for one election, I think.
Mm-hmm. A bomb scare in Times Square over the weekend, which I guess shows that it's really hard to be. People are vigilant, and certainly law enforcement officers are vigilant. And in New York City, they have to be incredibly vigilant, but this can still happen.
Well, it's very troubling because, you know, one of the amazing things that people constantly remark on is why have there been no attacks since 9/11, and why hasn't Al-Qaeda done the obvious thing, which is focus on small, you know, less spectacular attacks. They don't have to bring down the tallest buildings in the world. You know, you could basically, it seems to me, sort of paralyze America just with a bomb in a shopping center every weekend. You know, look at what the D.C. sniper did. He immobilized the nation's capital and without anything really spectacular, because the press will amplify it. If there's a bomb here, that'll be the story for 3 or 4 days, and then, you know, people will be scared to go to the shopping malls. And the really troubling thing is that maybe they shifted to that strategy, which is much more effective than plotting big spectacular things that you know, once every few years, and it's also harder to detect. But it's basically in order to stop it from having a big impact, you'd have to somehow have a conspiracy among the press not to publicize these things, and that's never going to happen. So it seems to me that's what's really troubling about this is, you know, we may be in for this for a long time.
Yes. Do you have any more information than I do about who this guy is they've been questioning?
I don't. We're in there is a Pakistani group that's claimed credit, and you heard, well, they often claim credit for things they have nothing to do with, but they do seem to have issued a statement saying they're about to attack American cities. I know nothing about the guy, and this is, we're in that awkward phase where each side is rooting that, you know, that he's an extremist from the other side. So I don't have any information.
We welcome phone calls for Mickey for all things political. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Mickey is a journalist, a pundit, and an author, best known for writing Kaus Files, a mostly political blog that is featured on Slate. He's written about public policy for Newsweek and other publications, including the New Republic and the Washington Monthly. We've covered a couple areas. One, of course, the oil spill. We're going to do a complete hour tomorrow. We'll talk with people who fish in the area who are obviously incredibly concerned about their livelihood, and we'll have a guest to answer the more technical questions about how you stop oil spills and if there's a way to stop this and the environmental damage. So those more technical questions we'll deal with tomorrow during our 9 o'clock hour. We've talked about the terrorist threat in Times Square and the immigration, and feel free to join us in whatever political area you would like. What do you think about the response, though, to this oil spill? It is massive. The president has been criticized for not doing enough. What is it exactly that he could do? And we welcome your calls. Lines are open for you right now for Mickey, and we'll be with you momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we'll be talking about 20 uniquely American tales covered in this month's cover story, The United States of Amazing. This is found in Mental Floss magazine, so we'll have some fun with that, our number two of our program. 800-486-8655 is our number for you to join us for all things political with Mickey Kaus. And the email, in case you can't get through, is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. Interested in your response to what it is that we could be doing about the horrendous oil spill along the Gulf Coast and the environmental disaster and the number of people who have lost their jobs. We'll explore a little bit more about the ripple effect this could have on the U.S. economy. We were talking also about the bomb threat in Times Square and looking at immigration rallies all over the country. Feel free to join us with whatever political conversation you'd like. Our phone lines are open. Where are you this morning? Everybody's enjoying the weather. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Back to the oil spill for a moment, Mickey. What do you think the potential ramifications are of this spill on the American economy? Is this a big deal here? And if, you know, you hate to go to a worst case scenario, but if it goes into the Mississippi, it's even more damaging. Are we going to see higher oil prices all over the country, do you think? Higher prices for food, et cetera?
I would expect that the economic effect would be marginal because you know, while the industries affected are badly affected, the economy is a huge, huge machine, and this is only a small portion of it. And there's a lot else that affects, you know, that affects energy prices. On the other hand, it probably will lead to much stricter controls on drilling of oil offshore, and it'll lead to restrictions of drilling offshore, and it'll, I think, as I said, prevent expansion of drilling offshore, and that will have a marginal effect. So I would tend to think that the human tragedy aspect of it is greater than the actual, you know, GDP deflation aspect of it. Also because, you know, unfortunately the cost of cleaning up is included in the GDP. So you generate a lot of a disaster generates a lot of activity in the cleanup. So people get employed, doing whatever is necessary in the wake of a disaster like this, and so it doesn't show up in the disaster doesn't show up in the economic statistics so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. On the immigration issue, I went to one of the rallies this weekend.
Oh, you
in Washington,
did.
And it's overwhelmingly Latino. I mean, in theory, immigration. Mexicans are only 50% of immigrants. There are a lot of immigrants from other countries. People of all nationalities who are here illegally and legally have an interest in promoting this immigration reform. But the rallies are do not reflect that rainbow. The rallies are 99% dominated, at least this one was, by Latino groups, and it's half in Spanish. And the rallies also always have a sort of benign aspect. It's not like the anti-war rallies of my youth. These are It's one of the most peaceful rallies I've ever been to. The issue is, given that it's an ethnic alliance and not sort of an abstract sort of, you know, civil rights alliance, if they pass this law and there's another wave of illegals, will these people immediately start lobbying to amnesty them too? And that's the essential element of trust that isn't there. Nobody really trusts, the Representative Gutierrez, who's one of the more respected leaders of the pro-reform group, to when he draws the line and says, okay, now the borders are secure, we're amnestying the people who are here, to really hew to that 10 years down the road when there's another group of people who are here in violation of the law he just passed, and will he really say, sorry, you people really are illegal, okay? We really mean it. You are going to have to go back, or we are going to have the police stop you. And when you go to these rallies, it's completely implausible that he would do that. So that's the essential. I realized that on Saturday at the rally. That's the essential element of distrust that the people pushing for reform haven't dissipated.
Well, into conversation coming up this half hour. Let's go to Lisa from Madison, our first caller. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good, thank you. I was calling because it was about the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and I always hear this, the news, and people asking this question, well, is this Obama's Katrina? And it always hits me. It's like, this is, for me, at least, it seems so different because Katrina was a huge failure of the levees. For years, the Corps of Engineers knew that there was this problem, and they never put the money into the infrastructure. And it was, you know, the hurricane response is the government's job, where here this is BP. This is a private entity's failure versus the government failure. So that, I guess, is my point or comment.
Okay, thank you, Lisa. Mickey?
No, that's an important distinction. Although if the private failure is big enough, the government is expected to respond. It's not even a second best solution to let BP foot the bill for causing massive environmental damage if the government could have stepped in and prevented it. So I do think that while the Katrina case was obviously more the government's fault, in this case, the government does have a responsibility. But people who are condemning Obama, it has to be more than he didn't show up for a photo op or he didn't go there. That always seems to be the phoniest charge. It was sort of phony against Bush too. I mean, he didn't go to. He flew over in an aircraft. He didn't go on the ground in New Orleans. Well, what difference would that have made? There were some concrete things he didn't do, and he's rightly held accountable for that. People who are criticizing Obama have to come up with something he could have done that he didn't do. And as you see, I haven't seen that yet.
Thank you, Lisa, very much for your call. Keith from Madison, hi.
Hi there. Pardon me. Good morning.
Hi.
So both of these issues seem to have a similarity in that I think one of our founding fathers liked the phrase, an ounce of prevention versus a pound of cure. And we kind of like to wait for this critical mass to envelop before we take these big drastic measures. And that's really unfortunate because we do, regular citizenry, we see these things coming. Now, I have lived in Arizona for 8 years, and I actually just got back from Phoenix. I was there for 2 years, 2 weeks, while this vote was going through. And when I spoke to people, not necessarily in the Latina community, there's a lot of empathy there for the Latina community and what the workers and migrants want to do in terms of boosting their own economic place in this world. But it's really the black market that is driving all the violence and the killings. They're really hoping for the Fed to take the step here, but they got tired of waiting for the Fed, which wouldn't take these steps, it seems, whether it was from lack of money or manpower. And so, as states, the state has the right to make their own laws. And really, when Texas passes their similar law in a half year, it's going to be a much bigger deal because it affects a larger population. And really, when you look at the ranchers being killed, whether it's by the drug smugglers or the coyotes, it's a very delicate situation to discuss, especially for, the regular Americans who've always woken up every morning in the land of plenty. And so I think, the underlying issue is more the black market, the black markets, which drive this violence, and not so much the people that are coming up to do, difficult work, which, typically I think we're all thankful for. And that's my comment. And
thank you, Keith. Thanks for the call. Mickey.
I agree totally with the sentiment. I mean, I live in Southern California, and you cannot live in Southern California and not appreciate the fact that immigrants, including illegal immigrants, are what make the place work. And they are basically a very benign and productive presence. I think everybody sort of agrees with, well, not everybody agrees with that, but everybody should agree with that. The point about the Fed not acting is also very important. And it's important in this way. It's much easier to stop the problem at the border than to let people in and then try to root them out once they're here and have established ties and they're living in the community. And so the so-called interior enforcement, as we're seeing in Arizona, is much more difficult than just having an effective border that prevents the problem from even happening. And the Fed has really dropped the ball there. I mean, Congress was a big show of passing a bill to build a fence along the border, and obviously Obama didn't want to build it, and Bush didn't want to build it, and so they said, "Oh no, we don't need a fence." We're going to have a virtual fence that's going to be, we're going to have monitors and TV sets and electronic sensors, and so we won't need an actual physical barrier. Well, that scheme turned out to be a debacle. It didn't work. And it wasn't really designed to work. They just didn't want a fence, not because they worried it wouldn't work. They worried it would work and would offend some of the pro-immigrant groups. They were worried it would offend Mexico and be sort of a symbolic diplomatic affront. And also, I don't think the border guards who patrol the border want a physical fence because it's cheap. It doesn't involve more border guards. And so the organizations that represent the border guards want these more complicated schemes that involve elaborate patrolling by human beings, when a simple physical fence would do the job and, you know, not require pensions and, you know, workers' comp benefits. So I think the end result of this will be that the feds will have to actually build the fence that they promised to build, and that'll hopefully be the ounce of prevention that will, you know, avoid situations like the one we're facing now. And then we also have to have some systems of letting all these good, productive people in legally. The legal quota is ridiculously low.
Mm-hmm. Well, when he talked about Texas, I didn't realize Texas was looking at a law about 6 months from now. My reading is that indications are that this law will be declared unconstitutional. Do you read it that way or not? Really?
I'm not so sure. They've done everything they can to try to prevent that. You know, obviously, if it contradicted federal law, it would be unconstitutional because the federal law would preempt it. But all they've done is they've made something a state crime that's already a federal crime. So they can argue that they're not contradicting federal law. They're just enforcing federal law, and federal law applies, you know, in localities too. The local police have to enforce federal law. It's the law. So I don't necessarily think it's unconstitutional. Plus, we have a more conservative court now, and this is clearly going to the Supreme Court. It's not like the California case where it was decided by a court of appeal. In this case, if a court of appeal decides to throw it out, it will go to the Supreme Court. I don't quite see how they can duck it.
Thanks, Keith, very much for the call. We go to Frank from Madison next. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Fine guest. I'd like to comment on the disaster in the Gulf. Two things. One is that there's a possibility that it won't be contained to the Gulf, and that if the leak lasts long enough, it'll start to move up the East Coast. So it may be a broader disaster with a lot greater consequences than is immediately apparent. But the second point is that this is something where we've been bitten by a failure to deal both with long-term sensible energy policies, where the costs of relying on petroleum and coal are mounting, and we've just had a spectacular example. But the shift to a different energy economy doesn't really have any conviction behind it. And there's no acknowledgement of the need to look at climate change and adaption, which also means getting away from a petroleum coal-based economy. So it's a disaster, but we should be thinking about the future and how we're going to adapt to the future. So thank you very much. If
you thank you.
Can comment. Thanks.
Thank you, Frank. Mickey?
I'd be interested in what he meant by adaption, because when I hear it discussed, that means that global warming is here and we are going to have to live with it and, you know, not build, basically move away from coastal areas and assume that the you know, the crops are going to change and all sorts of hundreds of things that have to be done. That's very, very expensive. I do sense, I mean, I come to Washington like two or three times a year talking to people. I do sense that there's a huge now movement behind solar and renewables that there wasn't before. And this has certainly given it more, you know, more oomph than it had before. I mean, there were plans to build a big solar facility in the desert in California that were held up by concerns about endangered species. I would think this would give those projects an extra push that would overcome those objections. And I see people talking about it. It's no longer a fringe, you know, oh, those crazy environmentalists. This is an area where mainstream businesses hope to make a lot of money.
Well, why do you think the president called for more offshore drilling? There were a lot of people who were upset by that.
I think it was a tactical move. It seems to be Obama's policy to make the concession sort of up front before the deal is cut. One example is he made a bunch of concessions to Russia long before he needed their vote on Iran. He made concessions to the pharmaceutical companies long before he needed their votes on health care. And in this case, I think he's making the concessions to the energy companies long before, or not so long, but before the actual legislation comes before the House and Senate. So it makes certain sense because it makes it seem like it's coming from him and not a grudging concession to the energy industry. But I think it was a bargaining chip that he gave to the energy industry before he wanted to extract something from them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see what he does with that now. Here's a challenge to you. This is from Maddie in Appleton. Mr. Kaus is sorely mistaken and historically tone deaf if he thinks that being asked for your driver's license 10 times a day is akin to being asked for your citizenship papers. The former, if it goes wrong, results in a slap on the wrist. The latter, of course, results in possible deportation and being separated from your family for the rest of your life. To ignore this is preposterous and, to use his own word, hysterical.
Why? The criticism is good. If I don't think that's what I was saying. I was just saying that the objection that the officials would ask you for to show ID is that makes us sort of German and let me see your papers is the sense that we're Americans, we're private, we don't have to tell anybody who we are, we can melt back into the woodwork. Is that sense of what America is has already disappeared. Obviously, it has huger consequences. A driver's license will do in Arizona. It's not, you do not have to carry. You do have to carry your citizenship papers, but you already have to do that under federal law. If you're here illegally, it's a very risky thing, to do. That's what it means to be illegal. And I don't think we want the people who are illegally to not to think that they are here illegally. Otherwise, if the welcome was 100% warm, that would be a huge magnet for more illegal immigration. The problem is you have to think, as the caller said about the oil spill, long term. If you do the completely compassionate thing and give amnesty to everybody who is here who hasn't violated the law. Without border enforcement, you're going to attract a lot more people for the next amnesty, the next compassionate amnesty. That's the dilemma of compassion, that what's good in the short term often has bad consequences in the long term. So you have to think of the long term, and that implies that there should be some consequences to being illegal. If we pass comprehensive immigration reform, after it passes, there are going to be people who come here after that who are going to be here illegally. Are we going to say, well, it's oppressive to ask them for ID too? At some point, you have to draw the line. If we don't draw the line, half of Latin America would rather live here probably than where they are.
Mickey Kaus is our guest for All Things Political. He's a political blogger, author of the Kaus Files on Slate.com. And he is also, we should say this, challenging Barbara Boxer in California's June Democratic primary. Our number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your calls at 800-486-8655. Tom is next from Eau Claire. Hello, Tom.
Yes. I have a couple comments about the subject you've been talking about. Number one, my own feelings, and let me put a little into this. I'm a retired pipe fitter, and as years I've spent working in the nuclear industry, there have been many changes in that industry, so as to the point after Chernobyl and after the Three Mile Island incident, which would have been one that was a real prime example to not have occurred had they had what they do now, which is an implementation. Everything that happens in the nuclear industry that's considered an accident, a human accident, is now broadcast through the internet to every single plant in the country, if not worldwide, so that they've got a chance to prevent that type of thing from happening again. Now, in this oil spill situation, number one, I think that the company, BP, should be held completely responsible for that. And if any bills are incurred due to that incident, it's their problem. And they pay for it, and it may sink BP. Well, then the other companies out there that are drilling in the offshore industry can be held accountable for what they're coming up. They're going to be more prone to implementing some type of a measure to prevent that type of thing from happening to them. And the end result will hopefully be a much safer process for doing the entire procedure of drilling.
Do you think, Tom, as a result of this, though, that all offshore drilling should be suspended until there is virtually no possibility of this happening again?
I think there's a very good chance of it. There had to be some type of an issue, some type of a accident that happened that caused this situation. And it's not 100% perfect by any means, but certainly there could be implementation of what went on, what caused it, and how to prevent it the next time. And the same type of a situation for every single little accident that happens.
Mickey?
I wish I had faith in the ability of all these safeguards to definitively prevent an accident, but we've seen throughout history that accidents happen, and they happen for weird human reasons, and you can do all these things, but you wind up fighting the last war, and you don't anticipate the new problem. And it just seems to me that the oil under the ocean near our coast isn't going anywhere. We can always tap it later if it becomes that important. But what this accident shows is that the costs of doing that are very great, and I don't think we're at the stage where we need to incur these inevitable risks right now. Nuclear, double that with nuclear, because the cost of a nuclear accident, if Three Mile Island had gone the wrong way, make the current oil spill seem relatively small.
Thank you so much, Tom, for your call. Dave from Menominee, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to bring up the talk about the Arizona thing. I was in Europe again a few months ago, and it was the first time it had ever happened, but walking into a museum, I was asked for my passport, which I didn't have. It was in my bag at my friend's house, which was a huge problem. I was detained, and he had to go produce the papers. Now, to think that somebody here with a driver's license, which illegals can get driver's licenses, that will not, I don't think, will suffice in Arizona. You will have to have, say, your birth certificate also, along with your driver's license, something else. Don't we think that the employers should be held accountable? Are there not laws already on the books that hold employers accountable? And why can't we keep track of Social Security cards, not just producing a card, but actually knowing whether that is a real number and it is the person that has given you the card? There are two Canadians, illegals, that live across the street from me. They've lived here and worked for 10 years. They're not going anywhere, and they certainly wouldn't be picked up and asked for any papers if they were in Arizona. They're as white as, my Swedish dad.
Mickey.
These are all very good questions. I do think, to take them in order, I do think in Arizona you cannot technically get it if you are an illegal, unlike Utah, where you can. And so the Arizona people have said that the driver's license will suffice in Arizona because they have confidence that they don't give them to illegals. It's been remarked that this puts a lot of pressure on Utah because a lot of the people who are leaving Arizona because they don't feel welcome there may move to Utah, and there may be a similar move in Utah, which has so far been much, much more liberal than Arizona. Forget what the second part of the question was, but the Social Security number and the verification program. You have to do employers, too. The problem is that the way the law is now, somebody just has to give a Social Security number and It doesn't necessarily have to check out. The employer just says, oh, well, you give me a Social Security number, I believe you, and then the employer is off the hook. There is a program called E-Verify that seems crudely effective. It's been described as 50% effective, which is spreading very rapidly among employers and may, in fact, have a huge impact when it reaches a critical mass. And that is an attempt to take the Social Security number that the worker gives you and check and make sure it's a new one, but there's a good one. But there's no fail-safe system because somebody could just fraudulently adopt a good Social Security number or even the whole identity of somebody else. There's if you take it back far enough, there's no 100% effective system of verification. But there are many programs that would be more effective than the ones we have now, and they tend to be stopped by the same lobbies that are lobbying for immigration, so-called immigration reform. They're stopped by the Chamber of Commerce, by the ACLU, by Latino legal groups, and they don't like the spread of these things, and so it's a constant battle to establish effective employer sanctions, and that's why I think we have to wait a few years and after we attempt to secure the borders to see if all the lawsuits filed by these groups actually eviscerate the laws or if the laws withstand them.
What about his point, and other people make this point as well, that his Canadian neighbors are here illegally as well, but they're not likely to be stopped because of the color of their skin?
Well, that's a good question. My impression is that there is some threat it's not that if you're white you have a free pass, but obviously extra efforts have to be made to make sure that this is applied fairly across all races. At the magazine I used to work for, The New Republic, one of our authors, Henry Fairley, was an illegal immigrant. And he did live sort of in the shadows. I mean, there are things he couldn't do that legal immigrants could do. I tend to think profiling happens, but I tend to think it happens less than the people who are profiled think it happens. In other words, if I had this conversation with a prominent black Republican official Saturday night, and he said, you know, profiling is real, driving while black is real. And I said, well, I get stopped all the time, and I'm white, and the police, they've profiled my car. They don't like the kind of car I drive. And I think, wait, I thought this only happened to black people. No, it happens across the board. But if you're black and you're stopped, you don't know about all the other people who are stopped who aren't black. It tends to be exaggerated in the minds of the people who are very annoyed that they're stopped. I'm not sure that if you're Canadian, you're home free. I think the Canadians I know are quite worried who had overstayed their visas.
Yeah.
And the border with Canada, we can be brutal. Customs guards have the power, I think, to keep you out for years if you annoy them. So I don't think the application is as discriminatory as this caller says. There is a very, very legitimate gripe that you constantly hear, which is, okay, you stop the people crossing the border. What about the 50% of illegals who don't cross the border illegally, who cross the border legally and then overstay their visas? We have to come up with some system to stop that. There is one in the Democratic bill. Nobody thinks it will work perfectly, but it's at least a start.
All right. We only have about 30 seconds left, but let's try and take this call. Jan from northern Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I'll talk fast.
Okay.
The article in Christian Science Monitor about a year and a half or 2 years ago said 90%+ of people come across the border from Mexico come in cars. They hire a person called a coyote that takes them across, and that's how they get across. I worked on there for 6 months on the Rio Grande River volunteering for Fish and Wildlife. The fact that the idea, the myth that this wall is going to stop anything is ridiculous.
All right, 15 seconds, Mickey.
Well, it seems to be cars are exactly what the wall can stop because the cars can't go over the wall. They have to come through checkpoints. So it just makes it more difficult. It's not 100%, but throughout history, walls have worked at least partially.
Thanks, Mickey, very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Mickey Kaus, political blogger, author of The Kaus Files on Slate.com, our guest for All Things Political this hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here this Monday. And just a reminder that we do All Things Political every Monday at 9, so we do kind of a look at all that's going on. And, of course, this week, a heavy focus on the horrendous oil spill along the Gulf and immigration, partially because of what happened this weekend and because of what our guest is particularly interested in. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with a fun hour. So stay with us. This is the Ideas Network.